One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Everybody, we got a great one today. You know, for a change, author Joe Connison on his new book, The Longest Con: How Grifters, Swindlers, and Frauds Hijacked American Conservatism. It traces how the modern right-wing movement, Donald Trump very much included, always had its roots in corruption. Connison traces how right-wing grifters exploited Americans' fears of communism. It's no coincidence that the first chapter of the book is about Roy Cohn, Donald Trump's mentor, who taught Trump how to rip off people, from contractors for his buildings and casinos, to contributors to the Trump Foundation, to students at Trump University, and then used the presidency to pocket huge sums of money. It's a story that starts in the early 50s with Cohn and continues through the decades, from anti-communist evangelicals to crooked right-wing politicos like Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, from Jerry Falwell producing videos accusing the Clintons of drug dealing and murder, to Pat Robertson's faith healing. There's a woman in Ohio who's just been cured of her diverticulitis, praise the Lord. And back to Trump and his various pyramid schemes, to how he and his family profiteered off his presidency and his $250 million of fundraising off his bogus election fraud claims, which he basically pocketed for his personal legal bills. Meanwhile, back on the 2024 campaign trail, I brought this up last week. There's this thing where Trump claim that in some Democratic-run states, not only do they allow abortion up to 9 months, according to him, but also allow parents to have their newborn executed. Well, a few days ago, Trump identified one of those states.
At the same time, the Democrats are radical because the 9 months is just a ridiculous situation, that where you can do an abortion in the ninth month. And, you know, some of the states like Minnesota and other states have it where you could actually execute the baby after birth.
I wonder why he picked Minnesota. Weird. Now, you, of course, know that no states allow parents to murder their newborn. Nor does D.C., nor do any of the territories. No executing newborns anywhere in America, it turns out. Now, also, Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, continues to have some of his problematic quotes resurface regarding childless women. You'll remember his childless cat ladies comment from his 2022 Senate campaign, when he said,
"We're effectively run in this country via the Democrats, via our corporate oligarchs, by a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made, and so they want to make the rest of the country miserable too. If you look at Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, AOC, the entire future of the Democrats is controlled by people without children."
Can't play that enough. Well, another comment resurfaced from the past where Vance attacked the American Federation of Teachers president, Randy Weingarten, also for allegedly not having any children.
So many of the leaders of the left, and I hate to be so personal about this, but they're people without kids trying to brainwash the minds of our children. And that really disorients me, and it really disturbs me. Randy Weingarten, who's the head of the most powerful teachers union in the country, she doesn't have a single child. If she wants to brainwash and destroy the minds of children, she should have some of her own and leave ours the hell alone.
Jesus, what a weird pick this guy was. Ooh, weird. He really just has a thing about women who don't have children or maybe can't have children. Oh, and he's against IVF because you end up with excess frozen embryos being destroyed as frozen fertilized eggs, which Vance says are human beings. But Trump now wants the U.S. government to pay for IVF, which is pretty damn expensive.
If I'm elected this November for the first time ever, your government will pay for or require insurance companies to pay for all costs associated with IVF fertility treatment. We want more babies to be born in America. We want more babies. We need them. We need them.
Anyway, we got Joe Connison today about his book, The Longest Con. It is a great one, you know, for a change.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This book is amazing in that it tracks all this grifting from the early 50s until today. And it's pretty encyclopedic in a way. And I told you I love the language in it. And I just want for my listeners to get some idea. There's so many swindlers here that here, I'm going to just read some of the language. Mainly nouns, but some adjectives and adverbs. And here are some of the words in the book to describe these grifters. Hustlers, swindlers, deceptions. That's obviously what they engage in. Malice, a falsehood and fraud. Siphon, as in siphon money. Money grubbing, grasping. Cynical henchmen. Gambit, dodgy. Stooges, greasing, scamming, corrupt, pelf. What does pelf mean?
Pelf is like loot. It's sort of a slightly archaic word for loot.
Dubious.
Yeah.
Skimmers. Cheaters. Sleaze. Rapacious. Phonies. Hucksterism. Disreputable. Orgy of venality.
Yes, well, you have to try to get sex in the book somehow.
Like-minded crooks, grease, grasping, I'm not close to done, trickery, fraud, malfeasance, then there is grubby,
yes.
There are smooth assurances given to idiots, scammy, endless chiseling of.
True.
Miscreants, did I do that before? No, grimy.
No.
Cronies.
Yeah.
That's amazing when I get down the cronies and I hadn't done it yet. Ignominious. Toxic. Amoral mentors. That's Roy Cohn.
Yes.
And rapacious. There, I'm ending on rapacious.
Yes, the thing is, having read the book, you know, it's jam-packed with bad people.
I think I was trying to.
And it's action-packed with their bad acts.
So this is from the McCarthy era. all the way till today.
Yes. And by the way, you said encyclopedic, and the truth is, it is kind of, except there's so much of it that you can't get it all in one book. So there are people who should be in this book, you could say, and they aren't for one reason or another. Like, there's not enough of Rudy Giuliani in it for my taste, frankly. So there are a lot of them. You can't really get everybody, but as many as there are, you have to have a lot of words to describe them, because if not, you're going to end up with the same few words over and over again. You're going to have kind of a bad book and you're going to drive yourself crazy. So it meant many trips to the thesaurus, you know, the online thesauri that are available to try to create some literary variety in the book. And I'm glad you appreciated that.
Well, I have a synonym finder. That's my book.
Oh, there you go.
That I use, which is very useful.
Yeah, you might want to send that to me for the next one.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's start with one of these grifters, and Roy Cohn certainly is a good place to start.
Yes, he's now a world historical figure. Before he was just kind of just a famous bad guy, but now as Trump's mentor, as I think lots of people know, he's had an influence on world history that's very malignant, and that was why I started the book with him. Con games and scams and misconduct of various kinds are pretty common throughout history. And you could have started a book about this in American politics at almost any point. But there is a point where it kind of takes over American conservatism, or starts to. And I thought it was a great sort of conceit because of Trump, because I knew the book was going to end up with a lot about Trump, to start with Trump's mentor. And so the first chapter is called The Role Model, and it's about Roy.
Where you start the book is where Cohn and a friend are on an assignment from Joe McCarthy to find what, communist literature in Europe?
Yes. So
European capitals?
Yeah. So the book starts with Roy Cohn when he's working for Senator Joe McCarthy. He really manipulated McCarthy a lot to get what he wanted out of the McCarthy Committee. And one thing he wanted was for McCarthy to hire a young man named David Shine, who I believe Roy probably had a crush on. He's really a dumb guy, but good looking. Mm-hmm. And Roy got McCarthy to hire him. And then they went off on a trip to Europe together, ostensibly to uncover communist literature that was being somehow put into the libraries in Europe of the United States Information Service. Because after the war, we were providing, you know, literature to people in sort of cities overseas that had their libraries blown up, or in any case, they needed literature. And it was part of America's propaganda effort, I guess you could say, to promote democracy in Europe after the war. Anyway, sure. We were sending books over there, and Roy and various other people decided, well, they must be communist books because it was a Democratic administration and, you know, we're going to root this out. And of course, there were no communist books, but they went over there and they went from one luxury hotel to another.
No, they were going to these capitals in Europe,
correct?
Right? To Paris.
They went to London. They went to Berlin. Mm-hmm. They went to mm-hmm. Rome. They had a blast, okay? And they spent a few weeks doing this, rousting the embassy personnel, you know, for these early morning meetings where they wouldn't actually show up themselves. I mean, it was a disgrace. Julia Child actually talked about it because her husband was in the Foreign Service and was working in an American embassy in France at the time. And she experienced this, one of Roy's visits over there. And it was just a ripoff. And he went on to many other ripoffs and scams. He was eventually, I'm sure you know, disbarred in New York before he died.
Right at the end of his life,
yes.
Right?
But I thought, you know, here's a funny little scam. Here's a funny little ripoff we could start the book with. It sort of epitomizes what this is about, which is under false pretenses, which excite people's paranoia and fear, you can go in and steal, basically. You can either get people to send you money, or you can take money from the government. Roy was a model for that. The other reason that I talk about him is he not only was a mentor to Trump, but he sort of shows how the conservative movement began to degenerate morally at a very early point. Because not only was he kind of a crook and a con man who, like, never paid his bills, never paid his taxes, ripped off his clients, and eventually, after a long time, got in trouble for all that. was indicted by the government three times and escaped conviction. He was nevertheless, in spite of all of that, the sort of poobahs of the right, the big names on the right, still welcomed him into their salons. He never suffered any sanction for being the kind of creep that he was. And so people like Bill Buckley and William Safire of the New York Times, the sort of the really great conservative dignitaries of that era, all called him a friend, and they celebrated him, and they like made sport of the fact that he was getting away with everything.
And what did he do for Trump? Because you say he became a mentor to Trump. Famously, when he was dissatisfied with Jeff Sessions as his attorney general, he said, "Where is my Roy Cohn?"
Yes. So Roy started his relationship with the Trumps and the Trump organization defending them against a federal lawsuit alleging racial discrimination in the apartments that Fred Trump and the Trump organization owned. They weren't renting to black people. And they had a whole policy around this. This was proved beyond any doubt, and they had to settle it. But that's when Roy and Donald first became friendly, and Roy took a big liking to Donald, who was actually quite a good-looking young man at the time, I would add, and became his mentor. Donald was from Queens, New York, didn't know people in society in Manhattan, but really wanted to be part of that world and to move into Manhattan. And Roy was a great guide for all of that, because Roy had all kinds of connections to the tabloid press in Manhattan and to the world of publishing, the world of media. This is exactly what Donald wanted. Donald wanted to be famous.
Did Donald want to be in the tabloids?
And oh, yeah. He wanted to be famous.
Who would represent him when he needed to get something to the tabloids?
Well, they had real press agents, Al, but I know what you're alluding to. He had his alter ego, which was, he used the name John Barron.
That's
and
right.
He would call up the tabloid columns, including my friend Susan Mulcahy, who ran Page Six at the time in the New York Post, and plant stories about himself. This is the kind of thing that Trump did throughout his life. I mean, there came the point that I talk about later in the book when he used the Trump Foundation secretly to bid up the price on a portrait of himself that was in a charity auction in East Hampton.
Right. So he could say it was the highest item.
It was the highest
item
bid and was on his picture, his portrait.
Right. So, portrait, right.
You know, but that was done, you know, under a fake identity.
And the foundation was later found to be a fraudulent.
No, they had to shut it down. Letitia James,
the New York AG,
I believe, forced them to shut it down and pay damages to the charities that they had never sent money to.
And Trump University also.
Trump University even,
had to be
even
closed
bigger,
down.
Had to close down. They had to pay $25 million in damages eventually.
Let's get off of Trump for the moment and Cohn and move on to the Christian Crusaders.
Oh, yeah. The Christian Anti-Communism Crusade.
Yeah. Frederick Schwartz.
Dr. Fred Schwartz. Yes. He was an actual physician, too. So when you call him Dr. Schwartz, it's not like some of the other quote-unquote doctors in the book who got their title from a diploma mill somewhere. No, Fred Schwartz was an actual physician who then switched to becoming a professional anti-communist, which is what J. Edgar Hoover called him.
Well, he
not
was.
In a complimentary
very
way.
Very successful.
Yes, he was extremely successful. He made what would now be millions of dollars going around lecturing people about the dangers of communism, which he vastly exaggerated.
Now, when is this? What period
this is
are we talking
late
about?
50s to early 60s, yeah.
In 1961, this is what struck me to give me an idea of how big he was. He had a Hollywood Bowl TV special sponsored by Schick Razors and Technicolor, the movie
people make films. Yeah.
And he had stars like Dale Evans and John Wayne and Ronald Reagan. So this guy was huge. And
yes.
All this was just Christian anti-communism.
His whole thing was to terrify people into believing that communism was imminently going to take over, that it had infiltrated, you know, all of our important institutions. And, you know, the only thing you could do about it was really to give him money. you know, for
here's the solution. Yeah,
so,
folks. Right.
So this was so it was so obnoxious and so scammy that even J. Edgar Hoover, who was not the man of the greatest integrity, to say the least, found this appalling. And they actually collected, you know, massive files on people like Fred Schwartz, because they believed rightly that to the extent that America faced an actual communist threat in the 50s and 60s, which, you know, there was definitely conflict with the communist world, these people were actually a hindrance to doing anything constructive about that.
Well, Billy James Hargis was one of them, too, right?
Billy James, he was a preacher, although he was the guy I was referring to from the diploma mill. He had gotten his degree from a fake divinity institute based in Puerto Rico that had been founded by a Nazi, in fact, from Kansas. But that's sort of beside the point. So he got into this grift as well. Billy James Hargis made a lot of money at this. He had a Greyhound bus that he had outfitted with a whole kitchen and a dining room and mustard colored carpeting and, you know, orange leather banquettes, and traveled around the country in this giving speeches. And meanwhile, he'd be sending out direct mail, and he was kind of a pioneer of the direct mail scam.
Well, Viguerie was part of his team.
And Richard Viguerie, who kind of became the king of direct mail a bit later, not too long after that, was operating that business for Billy James Hargis.
Now, just for everybody, direct mail is when you get something from a group in the mail asking for...
Yes, fundraising letters, which was how it used to be done for the most part. It still is done a bit, but now it's mostly on email. But yes, so direct mail was in those days in its infancy. And now we're talking about the early 60s, 50s, early 60s. But, you know, so Viguerie.
Richard Viguerie?
Yeah. So Viguerie was a young guy. He was a young lawyer from Texas, very right wing. He loved McCarthy. He hated the NAACP, et cetera. But he had this flash of insight, which was that after the Goldwater campaign in 1964, you know, Goldwater lost all but the handful of Confederate states. He got kind of wiped out in a landslide in 1964. But what he had done, he had gotten contributions from conservatives all over America, very right-wing people, and you had to file their names, right, with the clerk of the House. In those days, this is before the Federal Election Commission existed.
So with the clerk of the House of Representatives.
The clerk of the House of Representatives had the list of names in his files, and Richard Viguerie sent a bunch of women stenographers up there to write down all the names. He said, this is the greatest list. He had operated some of this with other lists, and the lists weren't very good, or they weren't very big. And suddenly there was this list of millions of people who had given to Goldwater. So he had them write those names down, and he got almost all of them before the clerk of the House realized what he was doing and tried to stop them. They put them on magnetic tape, which was the technology of that time, and they would be able to then mail out millions of letters to these people, asking them for money. And Viguerie became an enormous force on the right because he kind of had a monopoly on the fundraising, the gold mine, really, of these names.
Let's move on to other preachers. Jim Baker, Jerry Falwell, and help they got from people like Roger Stone.
So Viguerie goes directly into that because Jerry Falwell was a right-wing preacher who had made his name for himself by attacking Martin Luther King. He was in Virginia, Lynchburg, Virginia. And he got to be a little bit known for attacking Martin Luther King. You know, one of the things that I talk about in this book, Al, is that the origins of the religious right are not what they would have you believe. They want you to think that it was about, they started out by opposing abortion. And in fact, when they started out, the Southern Baptist Convention and other religious right evangelical organizations had actually endorsed abortion rights. What they were really upset about was the fact that the federal government was suing them over their use of religious exemptions to start segregated schools in the South. And Falwell had a segregated, what was called a Christian Academy in Lynchburg. And they were very angry that the Justice Department was scrutinizing that. So the evangelical movement began to become more political. And Viguerie realized that this was yet another source of names of people who could be induced to give money to a cause. And he went to Falwell and said, we think that we could organize the evangelical parishioners into a right-wing political group. Falwell sort of didn't believe him because at that time, evangelicals were not very political. So they actually did a poll. Viguerie and Falwell together paid for a poll. And the poll showed that, in fact, there was a constituency on the right among religious people. So that's how the Moral Majority started. It started out as a fundraising tactic.
That was Falwell's group.
That was Falwell's group. Falwell became the chairman or president of the Moral Majority, which was the biggest religious right group in the 70s. Now we're in the 70s. And became a force that helped to elect Ronald Reagan in 1980 and elect a bunch of right-wing senators. This was Viguerie's fundraising. And Falwell, as I say in the book, he actually used the Moral Majority a lot to raise money for himself, his church, what became Liberty University eventually. This became a grift for him.
I remember Falwell, now this is moving on to the Clinton era, putting out these videos.
Oh, yes. The Circle of Power. Yes.
Right.
Scurrilous videos about the Clintons that claimed that they were involved in everything from dozens of murders to cocaine smuggling, a big cocaine smuggling ring in the South that they supposedly headed.
And this wasn't true, was it?
It actually was not true. None of it was true. and that they had completely corrupted the government of Arkansas and stolen millions of dollars, blah. You know, it just one thing after another. It was all made up. But they made videos and they had people come on the videos and say these various things about the Clintons, various people in Arkansas. Then they would sell these videos because that was, again, the technology of the time. You would mail a video to somebody. So somebody would send you 1995 and you would send them this Circle of Power video. And they sold a lot of them. They made millions of dollars. Falwell and the guy who produced them, whose name was Pat Matriciana. They were so mendacious that, to use one of those words, that that the Republican newspaper in Little Rock denounced Falwell, and Falwell was disinvited from speaking in some churches in Arkansas because he's telling lies about Arkansas folks, you know, and we don't like that. But it didn't matter. He was, you know, they did very well off of those. And I wrote a book earlier that discussed some of this called The Hunting of the President, and we made it into a documentary film later. And I remember going to Lynchburg to interview Falwell for that film because, surprisingly to me, he agreed to talk to us about it. And he had no regrets about this at all. I mean, I confronted him about the fact that it was full of lies, and it didn't matter. He didn't care. It was in the past. He'd done it.
You know why? Because he was mendacious.
He was mendacious. He was extremely mendacious. By the way, violates one of the Ten Commandments that they want to post in the schools, which is thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor, which he did many, many times, and it's on tape. And now he's gone to his reward, wherever that may be. But he was a pioneer of, along with Viguerie, of fleecing religious people, who I assume are sincere in their faith, out of money by persuading them that the forces of, you know, Satan were about to take over America, and the only way to stop them, again, was to send money. Send money.
Also, now, there were prosperity gospel.
Oh, well, see, yes, preachers. That's a whole other category. In fact, Falwell, it's very funny because there came a point in Falwell's career when he tried to take over the Jim Baker and Tammy Faye Baker empire, which included an amusement park and all kinds of other
things. Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord. It was also known as Pass the Loot. They got in trouble, and they were vetted. Jim Baker went to prison. Falwell tried to take over their empire. And the reason he gave for his determination to do that was that Jim Baker was a prosperity gospel preacher, and Falwell considered that heresy. Why? Because the prosperity gospel, also sometimes called the word of faith, is a sort of non-denominational, it's not a sect exactly, but it's a type of Christianity, I guess, where if you have enough faith, if the preacher blesses you, you will be wealthy and you'll be healthy. And all these things will just come to you through prayer and tithing. And tithing is when you give to the church, and particularly to that preacher who's blessing you. So Falwell considered this a heresy, and he was right. It is widely considered a heresy by real Christians, but it's very big now. There are many of these preachers, including the ones who love Trump the best, Paula White. You know, you know, if you go online, you'll find these people, and they're all in my book. Kenneth Copeland, Benny Hinn, people who have made millions of dollars, Al, by getting people to send them money in the belief that if they send money, they will themselves become rich or be blessed and their health problems will go away. It's a cruel, cruel thing.
What was Pat Robertson's show? The 700 Club. There is a woman in Ohio who's just been cured of her diverticulitis. Praise the Lord. And you think, like, there are probably a lot of women watching the show who have diverticulitis. They hear that and they think it's been cured.
Right.
And so they eat a bowl of nuts.
And that's it for them.
And that's it for them. Goodbye.
Yeah.
So that was irresponsible, I thought.
Yeah, it was very irresponsible. Pat, of course, had his own scams and cons that I go into in the book as well. Pat, who ran something called the Christian Coalition for a while in the Bush era with Ralph Reed, another crook and con man.
Let's go into Ralph Reed's.
Reed is fun. So Ralph Reed becomes famous as the sort of the operative of Pat Robertson in founding the Christian Coalition. He was a young political operative from Georgia who built the Christian Coalition, and they did an amazing job. They built actually a big organization there. But then Ralph left the Christian Coalition. The Christian Coalition kind of faded away after Pat tried to run for president in 1988. And Ralph becomes a lobbyist in Washington. He decides to cash in on his political connections and become a lobbyist. And he hooks up with Grover Norquist and a guy named Jack Abramoff.
We remember Abramoff.
Jack Abramoff, who was a notorious lobbyist who went to prison because of his illegal activities and bribery and so forth. They used Ralph Reed to exploit his reputation as a religious figure, you know, religious leader, to help advance the interests of their casino clients, which is, of course, sort of the opposite of what a religious leader is supposed to do.
These are, and the one in particular was a American Indian.
Yes, Native American tribe. That was because some of them operate casinos. They have special privileges to do that. So Abramoff represented a tribe that wanted to stop another tribe from opening a casino.
They don't want competition from other casinos.
Right. And they're paying him millions of dollars, many millions of dollars. He has a bunch of these tribes who are hiring him as their casino lobbyist. And he was actually known as Casino Jack for a while before he went to jail. And they decide that they have to organize some kind of effort against this other casino that another tribe wants to build. Ralph starts a religious crusade against this other casino by organizing pastors to sign petitions and, you know, make noise about the fact that they don't want this other casino. But meanwhile, he's secretly working for the casino lobbyist and receiving money that's laundered to him through various ways to do this work and help them stop this other casino. So it's a gross abuse of his position and his connections purely for personal profit. And he was exposed in the scandal. By the way, scandal of that involving, you know, Abramoff, Ralph Reed, Grover Norquist, the famous opponent of federal taxes, all were in cahoots together doing this kind of thing, was exposed by Senator McCain, late Senator John McCain, held hearings on this in the Indian Affairs Committee and subcommittee. And the
committee I later served on.
Correct. And so that was an illustrious chapter in that committee's history, and the facts are all laid out in the hearings records, and it's horrendous. And the fact that, you know, Ralph escaped indictment, it's true, he was not indicted for any of this. He pretended that he didn't know what was going on. He had some considered transparently phony story exonerating himself, but nobody believed it. And when he decided to run for lieutenant governor of Georgia a couple of years later, he got completely waxed. Even the Republicans there didn't want to support him. However, time marches on, and of course, Ralph Reed is back. He has an organization now of his own called the Faith and Freedom Coalition, something like that, that is a big part of the Trump religious right apparatus. Because, of course, someone like Ralph Reed, a completely, you know, soulless scam artist like him, loves Trump and just sees he always was on the Trump wagon because these are people, no integrity is another way of describing them.
You should have put that in the book.
I should have put that in the book.
Now, here's something I want to get into is the Tea Party. When the Tea Party starts, there's all these different Tea Party organizations that are kind of competing with each other.
There's the Tea Party Express. There are at least four of them. And what happened was, so you know how the Tea Party phenomenon began. It was when a guy named John Santelli, who was
on the stock exchange.
Yes, he was a stock exchange reporter for CNBC. And he started ranting about how, you know, recovery program under first President Bush and then President Obama was, you know, a ripoff of something. He didn't like it. And they were going to have a Tea Party to protest all the capitalists, all the really good right-wing people. There was a surge of interest in that. And immediately, various of these political operatives descended on it to monetize and start Tea Party organizations that would, again, use lists and mail people and tell them, you can support the Tea Party, which is going to restore America and overthrow Barack Obama and bring back the good old days if you send us money. But the problem was, there were several of them that got into this business at the same time. And so there was competition. It became kind of really cutthroat. I describe in the book, some of it's pretty funny what they were doing to each other. But, you know, it was all about ripping off money. And the people, naive people who got involved with any of these groups, pretty quickly found out that the leaders of these organizations were in it for themselves. They were in it to skim as much money as they could. And they weren't really doing anything political. And this goes all the way up to the top, meaning Sarah Palin, who was a kind of icon of the Tea Party movement, as you probably recall. And she became an enormous grifter and was raking in millions of dollars after the 2008 campaign, mostly by pretending that she was going to run for president.
We're going to take a break for a moment. We'll be right back.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Let's go back to Trump.
The Tea Party leads to Trump.
Well, The Art of the Deal is his big number one bestseller, right? And Tony Schwartz wrote that and wrote every word of it.
That's correct. Without really any input from Trump to speak of, Tony now says it was fictional. It's a work of fiction describing the rise of a young real estate entrepreneur of great fortitude and genius and all of that. But that person doesn't exist and never did. But in the minds of the public, that book was a huge bestseller. They actually put on a fake presidential campaign to promote the book, and it sold massively. It's one of the best-selling business books of all time. But what it did, and if you talk to real Trump biographers about it, they call it the founding myth. This was the myth of Donald Trump as this great, brilliant businessman that was established in that book.
Now, a lot of people have ghostwriters, but this was just 100% fiction.
It was. I mean, the publisher of Random House at the time, who published it, Howard Kaminsky, said Trump didn't even write us a postcard. I mean, it's like there was nothing by Trump in that book at all.
And the next thing that led to his success was The Apprentice.
That's right.
So that's how this guy became president. It was The Art of the Deal and The Apprentice.
Right. So The Art of the Deal mythology laid the foundation for the broadcast of that mythology on the TV show The Apprentice, starring Donald J. Trump as the person I refer to in the book as, quote, Trump, unquote, which is, again, a fictional character, the captain of industry, the real estate mastermind, the brilliant billionaire, who at the time that The Apprentice was being filmed was about to go bankrupt. It was a complete fabrication of a persona, again, who did not exist.
But it's an entertainment. It's an entertainment.
Yes, it's reality TV, as they call it, which is a real misnomer because, of course, it's the opposite of reality. But yes, they created this fiction. But the problem with it was, Al, the line between news and reality TV it's very thin. It doesn't really exist for most people. People in the media, like you and me, understand the difference. There are some people in the media who don't care about the difference, but we know that there's a difference. People out in the world, they don't necessarily know there's a difference. And so there was created around Trump, millions of people, millions of Americans who believed in this character. They believed in the existence of this fictional person, Trump.
And I think this is why in 2015, a lot of people didn't take him seriously.
Yes.
So it was
if you had not watched The Apprentice, which I never watched when it was on the air, it was a hugely successful show. I'm pretty sure I never saw it. But if you had watched it enough, you would understand why Trump was a formidable contender in the Republican primary, where there were a lot of low information voters who, wouldn't have any reason to understand that this was fiction. And by the way, even lots of other people did not know that this was a fake until years later when the people who produced that show came out and basically said, we had to make up every episode and it was all fake. We would have to, script the show in order to make Trump look smarter than he was. And when we went up to Trump Tower to film it, we built a studio that looked good because the whole place was kind of falling apart because it was, again, about to go bankrupt. So the furniture was all chipped and lousy and we had to build, in fact, a fake Trump organization within Trump Tower in order to film the show. But the show was extremely successful.
Well, good for them,
I guess. Well, they made a ton of money. I mean, they made Trump, who was about to go down. Right. Saved his ass, brought him hundreds of millions of dollars, which he then proceeded to squander anyway.
Well, let's talk about some of his really sleazy money-making shit. The MLMs. Explain what an MLM is.
Yeah, so one result of the success of The Apprentice was that there's a whole group of credulous people out there, a very large group, millions of people, who believe that Trump knows the secrets of life. He knows the secrets of making money. He knows the secrets of everything. He's super rich. He lives this fantastic lifestyle. And it's because he knows things that the rest of us don't know. And this became an opportunity for him. Their belief became a huge opportunity for him to scam them out of money by selling them things and selling them the idea that they could be like him. So that's what Trump University was. Trump University, which we mentioned earlier, was called a real estate seminar scam. It's not the only one, but it was one of the bigger ones. And you convince people that you're going to show them the secrets of how to make money in real estate if they will give you, $5,000, $10,000, $35,000 to enroll in the courses where somebody's going to teach them how Donald Trump did it. Donald Trump, although he would initially claim that he had designed these courses and approved them and picked all the teachers and so on, actually had nothing to do with it. The closest he came to any of these courses was cardboard cutout figure of himself that they would set up.
They had promised them they'd get a picture with him.
They got
a cardboard cutout.
Right. With a smirking cardboard cutout, as I note, with a smirk for a good reason. So that was one scam that came in the wake of The Apprentice. Because he was no longer actually in the real estate business in the sense of building things anymore. The reason being, having gone bankrupt, he could not get any bank loans to build anything anymore. So he couldn't do that anymore and hadn't been able to do that for a long time. But these scammy businesses like Trump University and like the multi-level marketing, which you mentioned before.
Multi-level marketing, one of the funny things I think he did was a thing where you sold video phones.
Yes.
And explain what a multi-level marketing company is.
If you've ever heard of Amway, that is the biggest multi-level marketing operation. It's made some right-wing families very rich in Michigan, and the DeVos family, whom was appointed Secretary of Education, despite being devoid of any qualifications for that job, Betsy DeVos. It was kind of a big scandal when Trump was president.
I questioned her on the education committee.
Did you get a chance to do that? That must have been fun.
Yeah, I asked her just the most basic question, if she knew the difference between growth and proficiency in testing.
She didn't.
No, she didn't. And that was the most basic.
Yeah, I watched some of those hearings. I don't remember her being able to answer any of the questions that you or the other senators asked her.
No, and Lamar Alexander, the chairman, said we only had one. We could only ask one series of questions.
Oh, dear.
Which is ridiculous. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, that doesn't reflect well on him. But in any case, multi-level marketing is where you bring people in to sell something. And you mentioned the case of the video phones, which was one multi-level marketing network that Trump became involved with and lent his name and image to.
So in other words, you buy video phones or you get and then you sell them.
Yes. Other people get other people to join your network to sell them, but they pay you to join the network.
Right. That's why it's called like a pyramid scheme.
It's a pyramid scheme. They pay you or they pay someone else who pays you to join your network, and it becomes a pyramid. And in order to get their money back, they have to then go and sell a bunch of phones or recruit a bunch of other people to sell the phones or whatever it is you're selling.
Right.
And Trump had two of these. He had one that was selling phones and internet access and some other products, none of which worked. I mean, the phones that they were selling could only call other phones of the same kind. So they were a complete ripoff. And he also had one that was doing vitamins. And I love the vitamins one because the vitamins scam also included a urinalysis test that was part of what you sold to people so they could test their urine to see if how they were doing on their vitamin regimen. And of course, none of it had any health benefits whatsoever, but you would recruit people. And of course, Trump in these operations, he would get paid up front. He made his money up front because the people who were operating these multi-level marketing schemes would pay him up front millions of dollars for the use of his name and image, again, because the unfortunate dupes who bought into these things believed in him because they had seen him on TV and they had learned a lot of stuff about him that wasn't true, but that made them think that Trump was there to help them become rich like him. And that's what he said. He said, rather than make more money, I would just like to impart knowledge of my techniques.
Was he eventually sued by...
You know,
any of those people?
He was sued by a bunch of the Trump University people and also by the attorneys general of New York and California, and eventually had to cough up some money.
Yeah, it was about $25 million or something.
Right. There were lawsuits from multi-level marketing, but they have not yet even gone to trial. They're still, believe it or not, they're still suing him.
And then he becomes president.
Then he becomes president.
Does he make any money while president?
Yeah, I was going to say, did he stop stealing while he was president? And the answer, of course, is no. He found ways to monetize his presidency, not only for himself, but for his family, to hugely enrich himself. And there are many ways that he did that, Al. He spent a lot of time at his resorts. And, you know, when the president travels, I think you probably traveled with a president or two yourself. And so, you know, when the president travels, it's a huge operation. There are lots of Secret Service agents who go along. There's a whole retinue of aides and so forth. And they all have to be, as you would say, billeted somewhere. They have to be put up somewhere. And Trump would have them constantly in his hotels and resorts. And the federal government would be paying the Trump Organization for all of those rooms. They also, as soon as he becomes president, for instance, he owns a hotel in Washington. He happened to acquire a hotel in Washington just before he became president called the Trump International Hotel, very close to the White House. Suddenly, everybody and his brother is buying rooms, renting rooms in the Trump International Hotel, including
foreign governments.
Yes, the government of Saudi Arabia rented I think, 400 rooms at a time in order to make Trump happy. As you also know, as a former member of the Judiciary Committee, this is a violation of the Constitution.
The emoluments.
There is a clause in the Constitution called the Foreign Emoluments Clause, and it exists because the founders knew that it would be a bad idea. They had seen the corruption of the courts of Europe, and they knew it would be a bad idea for the head of state to be able to accept gifts, money, rewards of any kind from foreign powers.
I joined a suit to try to get him on this, but I don't think it went anywhere.
No, the different attempts to bring him to justice over the Foreign Emoluments Clause have not gone far. But nevertheless, it's very obvious that he's violated it on its face. And they've just continued to violate that. I mean, up to and including the $2 billion, you know, tip, basically, that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, got from the government of Saudi Arabia after Trump left office, after Jared left the White House, where he had been an advisor and had been sort of carrying contracts for the Saudis while he was in the White House.
Didn't Qatar buy Jared's building?
Yes, the government of Qatar, which is another Gulf state dictatorship, helped Jared and his family out of a jam in the beginning of the Trump administration when they're building 666 Fifth Avenue, a big building that was about to go under because they had really screwed up in the financing of it. Suddenly, the government of Qatar came in under some pressure from Jared in his role in the government to refinance that building. And so his family escaped bankruptcy in that instance.
And this is what we have to look forward to.
Yes. Well, I don't know if he'll be back, but some of them will be for sure if Trump becomes president again. You can bet. Maybe it'll be Tiffany this time. Who knows? But somebody will come in there. And I mean, you know, Ivanka made money when she was working in the White House to millions and millions of dollars.
Trademarks.
She had, you know, various types of trademarks from China that were worth a lot of money. But the Trump Organization is estimated to have booked well over $1 billion owing to the president's actions. And his refusal at the beginning of the administration to divest himself, as he was advised to do, of his corporate holdings, his companies, because the conflict of interest was brazen. And of course, that's what happened. I mean, they did all this.
Now, one of the great frauds that he did, he lost the election.
Yes.
And January 6th. And now we have this immunity decision from the Supreme Court that puts that in question. And we know that's not going to happen before the election. So if he wins, God forbid, he'll pardon himself his Justice Department will get rid of that charge, right?
Either or both. No, he will escape justice if he becomes president, no question about it, at least for the time being.
Okay. The court made sure of that.
Right. So what he did, I think what you're alluding to is, I mean, stop the steal becomes particularly an amusing slogan here, because after the election, as you know, which he knew he lost, and they all knew that he lost, but he's been pretending ever since then that he didn't lose, in spite of the fact that all of his objections were thrown out by courts up to and including the Supreme Court.
And Bannon announced that he was going to say won.
Bannon predicted what would happen on Halloween before the election and said, and it's on tape, Trump will pretend that he won, but he won't. He will not have won. And they were going to use the fact that some ballots would be counted later to pretend that Trump had won. So meanwhile, so flash forward, and they continue the Trump fundraising effort after the election, which is quite unusual. That's not usually what happens after an election. The campaign shuts down.
And what was the name of this fund? Was this Stop the Steal?
The campaign fund operation was known as T-MAGIC, which was an acronym. They basically sent out a ton of emails saying, we're going to have an official election defense fund that will contest the election and overturn Joe Biden's victory. And if you send us money, we will be able to save America from the Democrats and overturn the election. And they raised an enormous amount of money, Al. In 2 months, they raised on the order of $250 million from suckers who believed their spiel about how they were going to overturn the election. And instead, That money went into a super PAC that Trump controlled called Save America PAC, which he could then spend on anything he wanted, including himself. And he spent it on his own legal fees, right, when he was indicted. So in a way, it did have to do with the election because he and others who got in trouble for trying to steal the election had big legal fees, millions of dollars in legal fees. And so they spent the money that they claimed was going to go to overturn the election on protecting themselves from the consequences of their acts.
And then he pardons a number of people as he's leaving.
Indeed.
Including Bannon.
Including Steve, his advisor, Steve Bannon, that now the most famous American fascist in the world, got involved in his own little scam and grift, which is a very amusing one called We Build the Wall.
Yeah, this is quite ironic because they didn't actually use the money to build the wall, right?
They built a very small section of wall, but mostly they took the money and spent it on themselves, even though they had pledged very publicly, Bannon and his partners in this scheme,
that they wouldn't take a cent.
That they wouldn't take a cent. All the money was going to go towards the cause. And of course, this is the pattern that I've been talking about all along that we trace in this book, where this happens over and over again. They tell you, the poor sucker, that all the money is going to go to the cause. And in fact, they're siphoning off millions. So in this case, Bannon and his co-conspirators were spending money on their expense accounts, their credit card bills, cars, they bought a fancy boat. They bought all kinds of stuff. Bannon was spending money on fancy hotels and big restaurant bills and so forth. This is what they did. And they were caught and indicted by the federal government. By the way, while Trump was still president, the indictment came down in August 2020. Bannon was indicted along with these three other guys. And the three other guys, two of them pled guilty, and one of them went to trial and was convicted. Bannon was pardoned. Trump pardoned him. It was one of his last acts as president. Lots of people, even in the White House, thought it was a bad idea because it was such an obvious act.
Ironically, now Bannon is in prison.
Yes, Bannon is in prison right now for defying he didn't want to answer a subpoena from the House Select Committee investigating January 6th, because they would have asked him, well, what about that thing you did on Halloween and other stuff that right. You did around that? So he didn't want to answer questions about that. So he defied their subpoena. And, 2 years later, he's in jail. But what's going to happen, Al, is either while he's still in jail or very shortly after he gets out of jail, he will be on trial in New York because the authorities in New York indicted Steve Bannon for basically very similar crimes to what he committed in the We Built the Wall conspiracy. And he will go to trial for that. And I believe be convicted because the evidence, is, as I outline in the book, is overwhelming.
Well, why don't we end it there with Bannon cooling his heels in prison and soon to be facing a trial in the state court. And we've seen that the New York state court, how they do your trial.
Yeah, he's in trouble. I mean, they're very competent prosecutors, as we've seen, and it's the evidence is massive. I mean, that's why the other guys pled guilty, and he got a nice fat sentence for what he did, which was to steal from other conservatives. Al, if we're going to close, I want to say that this book is about right wing. All the list of names that we gave them before, these right wing scam artists stealing from other conservatives, mostly a lot of them old people, a lot of them poorly educated people, but people who believe in their cause, supposedly, and they're taking their money and giving them nothing for it. They love to talk about owning the liberals, but who they really own is their own constituents, their own people, and they rip them off mercilessly. That's what this book is about.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
What? One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.